Good morning. We'd like to call the Finance Committee to order. And our votes are in different order. Sorry. They changed the books and she got my own books. We have the agenda before us. Are there any questions regarding the agenda? Hearing none, the agenda is accepted as presented. This meeting has one information item, and its purpose is to address some of the questions that have been raised in regard to the budget, and these are responses back from staff to the board. And Ms. Kissel, you can begin.
Okay. I want to have a good morning, everybody. Hopefully, we'll be able to address some of the questions that we've had over the last several months of the committee meetings on the budget. And today, I'm going to have Bill Green, the Managing Director for Operating Capital, take you through part of the presentation. And we also have, Dave Kubicek, Gary Baldwin, and Rob Troop, who are going to address components of the presentation as it goes along. So bear with us. I think it'll be very informative and hopefully address some of the questions that you have. So, Bill?
Thank you. When we were before you in January, you asked us to come back and address several issues. The 2012 efficiencies, especially the $25 million. Cost reductions that we discussed briefly at the last meeting, the $200 million. Preparation for the Silver Line. Modal equity. The 2013 staffing plan, there was a request for more detail, particularly HR's plan and what we get for the investments. And we're prepared to do that in detail. And then finally, the capital program.
And can I might add, I'm sorry. I have there's a lot of blue pages in your package, and I will apologize for that up front. As we modified some of the things that we looked at more diligently with respect to real sustainable cost changes versus one time, some things appeared not as sustainable, and I wanted to make those changes. And that's why you have some of the blue pages. It's not substantial, but I wanted to make that note to you. So.
Thanks, Carol. So on the next slide, you asked us about the $25 million in reductions. Actually, in
I'm
the
sorry,
20.
I think your mic is not on, or you're not closer, but it doesn't
right.
seem.
How's that? Okay. Is that better?
I think it is.
Everybody, a little closer? Put on the side. There we go. How's that? Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
You asked us about the $25 million in reductions that we had included in our budget proposal last year. Actually, there was over $74 million in reductions efficiencies proposed last year. And the good news is that we've achieved or expect to achieve about $71 million of those. What this slide lays out for you are those savings that we don't think we're going to fully achieve. That's the health verification audit. That was the audit of the eligibility of our employees for health benefits, and we think we're going to get all of that, but about $1.5 million, or about $500,000, excuse me. The reduction in support services, we had anticipated $3 million, but we think we're only going to achieve about $2 million. And finally, the reduction in the parking contract. We are placing automated readers out on the red and green lines now. The project is slightly behind schedule. So we're not going to achieve those efficiencies, or excuse me, those operational savings until next year and the year after. Initially, we thought this program would have a 2-year return on investment. Now it's going to be a 3-year return on investment. Next slide, please. When we were here in January, we talked about the $200 million in reductions over the last 4 years, and I'd like to give you a little more detail about those now. Remember, we broke them into the three categories: sustainable, one-time, and cost restructuring. With the sustainable, of course, if you take a reduction in 2009, you should be able to realize that savings for the 4-year period that we're talking about here. And I'll talk about that in a second. Dealing first with the sustainable, we went back and combed through those reductions, and we totaled about $97 million in sustainable reductions. I'll give you some brief samples. The $23 million in services and contract changes, purchase service changes in 10, 11, and 12 combined. In the 313 positions we reduced in 2010 included 77 bus positions, 146 rail, and 88 administration. Many of these rail positions have contributed to our current situation with the state of good repair of the system. We eliminated the $10 million. We eliminated the chief administrative officer, consulting and other administrative reductions. $9 million of paratransit contract savings in 2011, and $28 million in other business operational changes, including bus operators. These are real wages for the what they call extra board. That is the additional time scheduled for vacations, sick, short runs, that kind of things. So we right-sized or reduced that amount that we were budgeted. So these ongoing savings, as I said, generate annual savings, and we estimate that over the course of the 4 years, those savings combine to about $200, $250 million.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Green, could you just, I want to make sure I heard you properly. You said relative to the 313 positions, the $27 million of sustainable there, that 146 rail positions contributed to the state of good repair?
What I meant to say was that the 146 of the rail positions that were reduced, you'll see later in our presentation, we're now asking for additional rail positions to be added back. Some of these positions were eliminated. So I think the GM has said the disinvestment in the system, or the underinvestment in the system many times, and this is an example of that, a disinvestment or underinvestment.
Thank you.
Thank you for the correction. On the next page, we'll flip to the one-time savings. Again, these are just as they imply. The biggie there, the reduced overtime and the fuel and propulsion. The fuel and propulsion in 2009, we reduced our fuel, or excuse me, 2010. If you'll recall, in the summer of 2009, fuel prices plunged, so we were able to reduce our price per gallon of fuel significantly, and that was about a $10 million savings. And then in back-to-back years, we've reduced our power about $6.5 million in the budget. Again, those prices fluctuate, so that's why we've included them in the one-time category. We reduced overtime twice. The biggest was in 2009. There was an $18 million reduction in overtime. One time it was taken out of the budget and subsequently added back. You asked for more information about the Silver Line preparation. This slide shows you briefly the ramping up. So in fiscal year 2013, we'll mostly be in the hiring training, and we'll be bringing on a lot of rail personnel, the folks that actually work in the right-of-way. Fiscal year 14, we'll continue the operations training and begin revenue service. And then by 2015, we expect to be in full revenue service. This next slide gives you a snapshot of where we anticipate the costs and revenues, and also we've got some fare box recovery information at the bottom of the slide. So you can see, reading from left to right, in 2013, the request you have before you in the GM's budget proposal for 2013 is $20 million. Once we begin, we'll get about a half year service in 2014, we'll ramp up to $43 million, and then by 2015, we'll be in full revenue service. And you can see there that the estimated revenue ramps up accordingly. And I'll show you some ridership on the next slide. At the bottom of this table, you'll see cost recoveries. Those are actually fare box recoveries, so they're not cost recoveries. And so we don't have the ability right now to determine all of the revenues, so we just focused on fare box recovery for demonstrative purposes. Okay, on the next slide, we're attempting to show you what we estimate the ridership to be in 2014, and then if you look on the far right side of the presentation, you'll see our estimated annual ridership. And you can see that, like the revenues, the ridership, the new passenger trips or the induced riders are growing, they'll double. And likewise with the current passengers who adjust their routes. This information was based on earlier forecasts. We have not adjusted this. You've seen this information before.
Before Bill takes you through this chart, I wanted to make a clarification. And the clarification is respect to a statement that we may have made publicly with respect to the demographics of riders on rail and bus. And I believe the statement was based upon some of the analysis that we were doing on fare concepts. We had made the statement that there was more lower income riders on rail than there was on bus. And that is not accurate. And I wanted to just take a moment to explain. In order to do the fare concept analysis, we used a basis of a fare survey that we did in the summer. And that fare survey actually was oriented, and the questions that we had on the fare survey were oriented to individual riders, and we were talking to them about their preference with respect to fares. That was the methodology that we used in order to come up with our fare concept discussion and then ultimately our fare recommendation. In contrast, and it was not meant to be a Title VI analysis, in contrast, when we do look at our major survey, which was done in 2007, it's a lot more complicated. And actually, that fare survey looks at more trips. So I guess if you had to look at a simple difference between the two surveys, the fare survey that we did to understand customers' preference on fare concepts did not really weight people's responses based upon the frequency of their ridership or the income. And so I just wanted to make that distinction. The fare concepts that we recommended still hold true based upon the survey that we did, and the elasticities that we used are really reflective of the methodology, which is, as I indicated in the past, unemployment, population, jobs, and things like that. So I just wanted to make the statement that the demographics the fare concepts was not meant to be a Title VI analysis. That will be, as you all know, forthcoming as we go through the public hearing process and analyze the fare concepts going forward. So just wanted to make that clarification.
Okay, I think we...
Okay, and then Bill is going to just take this little bit through the chart.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of other questions, if I might. Looking at, I'm sorry, I'm back two slides in the Silver Line preparation. So when I look at that 35% fare box recovery for the Silver Line, mm-hmm. That's for half the year.
Half the year, that's correct.
So you're putting the revenue up against the full year cost, though, right?
Yes.
And I think you need to asterisk that again from our funders looking at it. It's just good to keep reminding people that is the issue. Then going to the next slide, I want to ask the question: the average fare at $3. Mm-hmm. That's using our current fare structure.
It's using our current fare structure. Does not include the recommended new.
That's correct. So one of the questions I think we might have is, particularly off-peak,
yes.
if the off-peak were to go to percent of the full ride,
mm-hmm.
that would affect this average fare quite
yes, it
a
would.
Bit,
mm-hmm.
particularly for Silver Line riders because they're riding a longer distance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we really do need to have some understanding of that or some way to say that, because, again, from the point of view of the folks that we're selling on this budget,
mm-hmm.
That is a really important piece. Now, I don't know where we're going to end up. None of us know where we're going to end up.
Sure.
But I think we need to understand that a little bit better.
We can provide that.
But are you asking, I think the premise of the question is right, you know, this gives a guidance as to what we think we're going to see given those that startup, but the question is what actual fare policy will be in place at implementation. So are we asking for the optional revenue pieces that based upon the recommended?
To me, and maybe I'm thinking about this wrong, and I'm happy to be corrected, but I'm trying to think of this as a multi-year arc when I changed this fare policy. And one of the drivers of GAP is what's going to happen with the Silver Line. We don't know, right? So my only point here is this average fare is lowball. In the sense of everything else that we are looking at relative to fare policy
has an increase in it. And I don't want to be in the position of having overset my fares without understanding, you know, I don't want to raise fares too much. I want to calibrate fares.
And what I'm asking is for information in terms of being able to provide the options that
yes.
we have in the current piece that is going to the public so that we can have from to that range.
Yes.
So that somewhere within that range we can start planning.
So just for clarity, you want us to give you what the revenue would be if we adopted the general manager's proposal, and then do you also want some of the other options on the docket, or do you just want to stick with the general manager's proposal?
Madam Chair,
yes.
A further question on this. Mm-hmm. When you say fare, that only includes the fare and not the parking?
Yes, that's just the fare, not the parking. Yeah. So, actually, it's a good...
These people who pay a significant amount of parking
right.
would also be contributing mm-hmm. towards fare court recovery. Yes, sir.
Except the parking garages that are being built out on the Silver Line will not be owned by us.
Got it.
Under
okay.
the current agreement, anyhow.
At least the current proposal. Right.
That's only one. There's only one, but that's not the point.
I guess that's a fair question, Mr. Stiles, about what we actually want. And so maybe we can.
That's what I.
Well, I certainly want the GM's proposal. But whether there's some others that we ought to price out because they would have a dip there in the middle, that would be, you know, we'd have to think about it. But I would like people to understand. I think we need that information to make the decision.
Okay. Okay. All right. Yes, Mr. Downs.
I'd like to go back to the chart on operating expense forecast. Is that a fully loaded allocation of cost, including overhead, pension, fringe, overtime? It's fully loaded.
That's correct.
What's the total operating budget of rail forecast for the coming year?
I don't have it on the top of my head.
Sorry, I should know these.
You got it?
It's $900 million. If I remember, both from a mileage standpoint and a station standpoint, this is somewhere at an 8 or 9% increase in both stations and track mileage for the rail system. And at that, it would come out to, if this is a 10% increase in the rail system, that's a lot less than a 10% increase in total fully loaded cost. And I was just curious about why this is so much less than the percentage increase in the system.
Well, I think when we get into the further presentation on the staffing plans, that might be able to address your question.
Okay.
What this slide shows, as Carol mentioned, with the numbers from the prior Title VI equity analysis, that our total minority riders, while rail has a higher total number of minority riders, the bus percentages are significantly higher, nearly 75% of those riders. Conversely, on the low-income trips, bus has both higher numbers in terms of total riders and also significantly more as a percentage of their riders. Next, this is the slide that has the breakdown by mode, and you can see there it also includes the revenue on the top with the fare recommendations, shows how the $66 million is distributed across mode, and then also our operating expenses. One important distinction, this cost recovery is full cost, including parking and all other costs, as opposed to the prior display with Silver Line that was strictly fare box.
Mr. Dale.
Gross subsidy does not include our capitalization of a number of expenses in the system. There are no capital numbers, including jurisdictional capital.
That's correct.
And the allocation. It is helpful to understand the total cost of a system, both bus and rail, about at least the local jurisdictions and the state's capital investments. Those are cost. They're not covered by farebox. It is perhaps misleading to say that the cost recovery on rail is 80%. It's probably not 27% on bus either. But at least including the jurisdiction's capital as part of a calculation that shows an alternate way of looking at what real costs are.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think in the transit industry overall, we use the term cost recovery with respect to fare box and operating costs. But as you point out, if you really want to look at it from a business perspective, you would definitely have to incorporate your capitalized costs. And so we can show that as well. As you know, the capital cost is also funded and subsidized by the jurisdictions and the federal government. So.
At least a indicator of the cost of depreciation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A railroad and a transit system eat themselves up every day of operation. Mm-hmm. They consume capital every single day. And not having a depreciation account is an artificial way at looking at actual fare box recovery.
Moving on to the staffing part of the discussion, you've seen a lot of numbers, and I'll quickly go through them. This is the proposed headcount that we presented to you, and I've broken it down by the various initiatives. You can see there the capital reconstruction, 255 to fund our almost $900-plus million capital program, 363 positions for the Silver Line to prepare for operation and maintenance of the new system. 194 head count to maintain the baseline positions, including new parking garages, maintaining the new parking garages, providing adequate rail car maintenance, and other communication equipment, the blue-yellow line split support, and then 255 for system investments, including fatigue management. We'll get into a lot more detail about this as we go farther into the presentation. Could you flip back, please, and put that other slide up to near the presentation? You're going to see a lot of different numbers, and I know that it can be confusing, so I wanted to just step you through the headcount. When we were here before you in January, we were talking about 1,013 headcount. As part of our reconciliation to the budget and headcount in 2012, we discovered a 76 headcount difference. Let me talk about that briefly. This was a systems issue. We had multiple systems. In June, you delegated to the GM the authority to manage headcount. Immediately, he asked us to put controls in place and to reconcile the systems and get an accuracy and come to, as Carol likes to say, one number. We notified the GM in October that there was a discrepancy. So what this is a reconciliation of existing positions between the two systems. And we're now going to update this 2013 budget book to get the systems reconciled. At this time, we're assuming that the escalator and elevator maintenance that we had previously thought we would be conducting with internal staff, we're assuming that we can do that with contract. So for the purposes of the next display, as Gary Baldwin steps you through, we're removing those headcount.
Just on the orange line.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. So What Mr. Baldwin's going to discuss now is 877. I just wanted to do the math because I know there's been a lot of numbers kicking around. Gary?
Can I, just so I, because this is new information for me, just so I can understand, when you, reconciling is looking at what your system carried as the staffing level.
Yeah, so and, let me.
And I just wanted to go back. And when we got the 1013 number, you were between, I thought we were just reconciling what were the actual staffing heads versus the vacancies and the actual amount to close out the year versus reconciling what
I think operational the difference is when we look at the 1013 number, it's really just a year-to-year number. Mm-hmm. And as you know, headcount's not it's a dynamic thing. So that's where we're looking at budget comparison to prior year budget to now the forward budget, and that's where you get the year-to-year. The reconciliation, given the delegation that the board gave to the general manager to manage headcount, we immediately, in the fall, reconciled. That does not mean that the 70-so-odd headcount cost was not in the budget. It was. It just meant that we did not have a proper system reconciliation of that. So that's all the difference was, and we wanted to make sure that you understood that. As we go forward, we have those controls in place. As every headcount is added to, whether it's operating or capital, we actually have a process where the general manager would approve those or disapprove those, depending upon his authority and means.
Could you put that previous slide up there?
Sure.
Again? No, the one that, the new one.
Yeah. Right.
The reconciliation one. I don't think we've seen this one before.
No, it's actually a new one just to walk everyone through it. But just leave it there. Don't touch it.
This is important as Gary tries to explain to you, because one of your other questions was, how are you going to bring all those folks on board? And so I wanted to make sure I got you the right base so we had a good starting point.
Can I just one follow-up? So the 76 people were in 2012 in two places. You've gotten them down to one place. Is that, I mean, there was a double count?
From a system? No, there's no double count. I guess with the cost, it was in one system, not the other. So the cost was always there in the budget that was approved by the board. We just didn't have the allocation properly in one system.
So right. It's not that we had twice as many people
funded? No, okay. That's correct.
Now, can you go and run this parallel to the slide on page 17?
Sure.
I'm having trouble getting from the 877 to the 953.
Sure, let me tell you the difference between this and slide 17. Is the reconciliation. And the reason it's different is that when we talk about the 877, as you'll see in Mr. Baldwin's presentation, 76 of those are already on board. They won't be part of his recruitment. So I'm stepping you from a we're gonna detail the 76 further in the presentation, but from a hiring perspective and a recruiting perspective, those 76 will not have to be recruited. Thank you. Does that help?
Yes.
Thank you.
Back to the other presentation, please. Back.
things, Bill. Gary Baldwin, HR officer for Metro. Purpose of my discussion this morning, and it's focused essentially on describing how we are going to tackle the key elements that are displayed on this chart and the particularly the new positions that Bill has outlined in different major categories. Just for your information, those specific positions will be more specifically discussed after my presentation in terms of what makes up that 877 and what each of those positions will be involved in addressing in terms of system issues and operations. My main goal here this morning is to address our plans and strategies to accomplish the hiring needs for the balance of 2012 and to accommodate the proposed increased staffing that Bill has just outlined for 2013. And I don't want to minimize the effort that will be needed in that regard. This is a very heavy lift from any perspective. But let me first address the background and context of hiring in Metro, just so that you have that in mind as I talk about the strategies for going forward. Right now, HR fills an average of 1,200 budgeted vacancies through the competitive recruitment process each year. So that is our starting point already, that is the average that we fill on an ongoing basis as part of our baseline. What that entails are two key components, external new hires, and that involves hiring about 700 to 900 people a year, and that represents about 65% of our total competitive recruitment. The other one-third is essentially internal competitive recruitment, where we advertise a job and a person within the organization applies for it. They go through a competitive process and they're selected. That is a good thing, but it is also a complicating factor in terms of when we're dealing with vacancies, because as you select internal candidates, obviously that creates another vacancy for that position that was left vacant as a result of the promotion or a new assignment. But in any event, that is our competitive recruitment process, external and internal hires, and the bulk of that is external new hires. For this fiscal year through December 31st, HR has filled about 780 vacant positions. That is a 28% increase over the same period of 2011. And if you extrapolate from that, if we stayed at that same level, we would be filling, instead of 1,200 vacancies this year, we would be filling something like 1,400 or 1,500 positions. So that's kind of to give you a perspective of the baseline that we start with in terms of our ongoing recruitment. Our overall authority-wide vacancy rate is 6.6% currently, and our attrition rate is 5%. That's just to give you the context of what we are doing currently, how we do, what the proportion of external versus internal recruitment. And now I'd like to address, if you look at the chart, obviously, we have in the balance of fiscal year 2012, the last two quarters of 2012 to June 30th, we will have to augment our hiring approaches in order to meet the targets not only within 2012, but to position ourselves for the very heavy lift that we will have to do in 2013. In 2012, we will be doing a lot of advance hiring, not not actually putting people on the rolls, because the positions don't become official until 2013. For example, fatigue management. We will be hiring 91 critical fatigue management people. We will do the pre-recruitment efforts in 2012, so they will be in active recruitment mode in 2012, and they will be on board as of July 1, 2013. That is a commitment that we have made to the general manager in terms of having those in place officially on July 1. But the recruitment can't start as of July 1st. We have to have them on board by July 1st. We will also do accelerating hire schedule for the remainder of 2012 to ramp up our current authority-wide hiring volume from an average of 300 hires per quarter to over 500 by the end of quarter four in 2012. And our efforts will be targeted toward closing the resource gap and stabilizing the authority's vacancy rate in a very proactive way. For 2013, and as you see the spike there, what that spike represents are two things. One is having this pre-recruitment effort that will position people to be on board as of July 1. That's one piece of that spike. But also to begin the active recruitment for the Silver Line, skilled job classes for the Silver Line, transit police that will be needed, and other systems investments. And then in quarter two, we continue the Silver Line and include additional MTPD support officers and special police, and the continued ramp up of the Silver Line. And then in quarter four, the final infrastructure support staff of the Silver Line. Now, of course, this represents the balance through the end of quarter four of 2013. The hiring will not drop off dramatically when we reach the end of quarter four of 2013. There will be continued recruitment into fiscal year 2014, but since this is the 2013 budget that we're talking about, that is not displayed here. The three major components of our recruitment strategy, and I'd like to go through those rather quickly, there are three key elements that we will be doing in HR to address this very robust hiring effort that is displayed on this chart. One is reengineering of the HR recruitment infrastructure, and I will talk a little bit specifically about that, expanded sourcing initiatives, and expedited streamlined recruitment processes. So I'll spend a little time talking about each of those three as best I can. On reengineering of the HR recruitment infrastructure, we've known for some time that we needed a better model for recruitment within WMATA. We've also had some assistance from the Mercer Consulting Group, which is a highly recognized HR consulting group nationally and internationally. And they have recommended a model based on a study that they did last fall for us, which essentially would establish a dedicated staffing organization within HR. And that is the model that we are going to use and have already started to flesh that out. This would essentially involve a recruitment staffing group which was 100% dedicated to talent acquisition, and it will be comprised of professional recruiters, sourcing specialists, and recruitment support staff. We will need additional FTEs for this, and the general manager has approved to supplement with 8 FTEs for this purpose. We also are moving forward with any vacancies that we have in HR to convert those into these key recruitment resources that I've just outlined. And we will supplement as needed with contract resources as we gear up this staffing model. We already have moved in that direction, and we have brought on board two and are about to bring a third technical recruiter on board. And I'll talk a little bit more about that because we've had some fair amount of success with that approach. The second main element of our strategy is expanded sourcing initiatives, and this includes expanded strategic partnerships with BC, Virginia, and Maryland Departments of Employment Services. We already have established relationships, but we are taking them to another level. We are doing some very creative things right now with DC Department of Employment Services in terms of using their good offices to do pre-testing for us, and we're interested in working out a memorandum of understanding to make that occur. But we've also cooperated with DC, Virginia, and Maryland in terms of our robust bus operator hiring program, and I would like to talk about that a little bit later in terms of how that particular model is going to fit into our plans here in terms of a broader approach within Metro. A broad utilization of new and expanded sourcing tools and job boards, and a focus on mass testing events. For example, that is a technique that we employed. As many of you know on the board, we had a particular challenge in terms of bus operator vacancies about over a year ago. We did step up to the plate and structure an approach with HR resources to basically do mass testing and to accelerate different aspects of the process to bring on larger numbers of qualified applicants for the bus operator trainee positions. As a result of that effort, we basically eliminated the vacancy problem for bus operators in the agency, and we've now reached a stabilization point where we have an ample pool for the pipeline into rail operator and train rail operator and station manager positions. We are going to use some of that mass testing technique for other positions where we have high volume recruitment that has to occur as part of this major recruitment that we're talking about here. And then the third leg of this strategy is expedited streamlined recruitment processes. And this will involve expansion of vendor services for expedited medical and background screenings to supplement our existing resources, particularly on the medical testing side. Expansion and replication of pre-qualification and speed hiring concepts currently being successfully piloted with as a part of the capital recruitment program for Rob Troop's organization in CENI. And what this involves, and this holds a great deal of promise, this is a concept built around a dedicated specialized recruiter or recruiters accountable for managing the recruitment process, implementation of pre-qualification of top candidates, which are routed for interview, and development and implementation of predetermined compensation target salaries so that we can make same-day offers to candidates when we bring them in for final interviews. We, for example, conducted a very successful event on January 11th with 29 candidates for positions as construction inspectors, construction facilitators, and assistant project managers. Out of that group of 29, 16 hires to date are on board with a potential of 7 more. That all transpired as a result of a one-day event. That is the kind of economy of scale we are seeking to get, and we intend to replicate this particular process not only in Rob's organization, we'll probably expand it in Rob's organization, but also extend it to IT and other high interest areas where standard recruitment techniques are not as successful as what we would expect. Finally, I would just say that HR has developed an implementation plan and schedule to put these recruitment strategies in place and to enhance our recruitment structure. And that will occur essentially this month and next month and be ready to really go forward in a very much more robust way by the end of March and early April. So that is basically where we are in terms of our approach to addressing the rather dramatic increase in recruitment that has been outlined as part of the budget proposal.
Thank you, Gary. So, are there any questions regarding this?
Yes, Mr. Downey. Two questions. At the end of this, if successful, what will the vacancy rate be?
Pardon?
What will the vacancy rate be if we work through this whole?
Well, I knew that question would come up. I don't think we're at a point where my thinking on the projected vacancy rate. I think once I have the elements in place for making this model work successfully, and then seeing after 2 or 3 months of full recruitment with that new model in place, then I think I would be in a position to be able to project how that will impact the vacancy rate going forward. So I think that from my standpoint, I think that's the better way to discuss that.
Darrell, as you do the budget, you always take into account that a certain number of positions will be vacant. Right?
Oh, yeah. Gary and I work very closely together.
The other question I had, just refreshed my memory from the discussion a year or so ago, how many people do you have to winnow through, particularly in the bus operators, between initial contacts and final hire and finally getting on the job?
I don't have an exact number. It does vary. But I would say for the bus operator, that's probably our greatest challenge is assembling the initial pool. And given the fact that we have to, anyone who comes into that pool has to go through several hurdles. And by the time you get to the end of the pool, you end up with a very, very small number of qualified people. But I would say, on average, we have to have a pool of at least 300 people in order to get a trainee class of 25 to 30. That's pretty daunting.
Okay, Mr. Barnes and Mr. Giancola.
Gary, I know you had a big program for military veterans recently. How successful was that?
That was very successful. I don't have the exact numbers here, but there were over 350 people that attended that program. We had I wish I had brought them with me, but I believe the numbers, I think I better get back to you on that. But we have the, I believe there are 34 offers that are, that have been made, and they're still pending background checks and medical. It was successful. We also did a very successful, participated in a very successful event at the D.C. Convention Center for Veterans just recently. We don't have any direct hires coming out of that yet, but we had a number of qualified people who are under active consideration. And as I said, the other major event that we did was the one with CENI, which produced some very, very good results.
Okay. Mr. Giancola.
Thank you, Mr. Boland, for the primer and recruitment. It's very helpful. Question, a couple of meetings ago, I don't remember if it was the last meeting or the meeting before that, I thought I heard that we had a vacancy rate of 9 or 10%. Now I heard you today say we had 6%.
Yes.
What is it?
It is 6.6%. Now, that is authority-wide. I misspoke on the previous board discussion. I did peg it at a higher percentage rate than it was. While it's 6.6 authority-wide, if you look at the different parts of that, for example, on the capital side, that is operation and capital. If you look on the capital side, there is a 10.8% vacancy rate, if I'm not mistaken. So, but I was, the number for authority-wide, when you take operations and capital into consideration, is 6.6% as of December 31st.
So the operating actually is below 6%.
Yes, it is.
Okay, all right. Thank you. That is helpful. My second question related to what Mr. Barnes had talked about, the veterans recruitment effort. As a veteran, I'd certainly like to see a real emphasis in that area as well. Thank you.
I just have one question. When you talked about the resource initiative and you referenced the jurisdictions, you are looking at the employment services of those of the states, but are you working with the jurisdictional HR?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we are.
All right, thank you. Okay, I'm sorry, Ms. Humphrey, if I want.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions and then observations. I was really encouraged to see the plan sort of reengineering of recruitment, because in our earlier briefings you talked about your initiative with HR reengineering generally. And I just wonder how the other initiatives relate to, and time frame, relate to what will be this major initiative because of the required hiring. That's one thing. The second is in terms of expanding sourcing initiatives, the initiatives with employment offices in other jurisdictions is great. We'd also previously made reference to, especially when we were looking at the work relating to escalators and hiring people to do that kind of work, initiatives with public schools in the region who are involved in preparing young people for work readiness as well as higher education, if that's a possibility, and are we exploring that? And then I noted you have a list of items from the GM's memorandum to us that are identified as critical to the success of this initiative. I think you've laid out a great plan, but it seems you've also anticipated those things that might go wrong. Do you mind sort of reviewing with us the things that might go wrong and that are critical for success?
Well,
at least the five that are identified. And just the one comment I would make, too, in terms of the background checks for the police department. I wonder if there's any collaborative efforts with the other police departments who are performing the same function and are in high-level recruitment so that there's a little more synergy in terms of getting those background checks done.
We're having preliminary talks with the chief on his recruitment needs, And that's going to be a fairly complex set of recruitment challenges, I think. But I think as we move into that arena, we will be looking at all possible avenues to enhance that pool. And if that means indeed going beyond what our normal jurisdictional boundaries are in terms of the pool that might be available, we intend to do that. In terms of the critical success factors, yes, there are a number of those. We have every expectation that we're going to be successful. It is going to mean staying in close collaboration with the hiring departments and knowing exactly what their forecasts are and how those forecasts might change, because that affects what we recruit for and what resources we deploy. We have to look more carefully at our pre-screening and testing requirements because that impacts how quickly we can do recruitments, and we're getting support within the organization on those kinds of things. We have to look at our policies and procedures related to hiring to make sure that we streamline as much as possible, and that we have adequate technology enhancements in place to assist us in the recruitment process.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Porter.
So I'm looking again at your projections on this slide here, and under reducing existing vacancy rate, you have a large difference between FY12 and FY13. Could you talk a little bit about why you think, I mean, I assume when you're talking about existing vacancy rate, if you can talk a little bit about why you think you'll have made as much progress as you will have by the end of FY12. You've got, for the last two quarters of FY12, you've got 150, 120, and then in FY13, you've got 20 or 50 for each quarter.
And
so when you're talking about I assume when you say existing vacancy rate, you're talking about the vacancy rate that you're trying to fill at this moment.
Yes. The overall being 6.6% right currently. But again, there are pockets of that vacancy rate that, for example, in Rob Troop's organization are much higher. Authority-wide, it's 6.6%. But in Rob Troop's organization, for example, there's a critical need to fill certain capital positions, and that vacancy rate is higher. So that is part of what we are attempting to do in these final two quarters, is to focus our energies on those pockets of critical vacancies that we need to fill, which will ultimately bring down the overall vacancy rate, but will address the key critical areas that remain not fulfilled at this moment.
Just let me clarify that. Several months ago, I added positions in the capital area, which then created the vacancies. So as a result, we've been pressing forward to fill those vacancies. So this is not a long-standing vacancy rate in capital. Those are recently created vacancy rate because we added more capital positions. I wanted to get moving.
Okay, and your sense is that you can fill the bulk of those by the end of fiscal year 12.
That's what's underway.
Okay. Let me go to Mr. Downs and then Mr. Dyke. Oh, Ms. Hines.
If you're successful in reducing the existing vacancy rate, what is the relationship to your overtime budget number?
I'll answer just very plainly that if when that vacancy rate gets met to the goal, the overtime should actually be reduced. As you know, they're very relational, so overall that should happen.
Let me just clarify. The FY13 overtime budget is supposed to be realistic based on hiring these people. What we've encountered, as you well know, over the last few years is we have an overtime budget, we skyrocket past it, and it's offset by not having their vacancies, positions filled. So the budget reflects over time with these people hired.
Mr. Dyken, Ms. Hines.
Just a brief question. In your creative approach to HR, has there been any effort at all to work with the local community colleges to let them know that these are positions that you're looking for and their program that they're being, that they're offering that could help us in that effort? Has that been a part of your plan?
We do not have in place at the moment established relationships with other than a couple of technical colleges. What we do, intend as part of our strategy, as far as our sourcing is concerned, is to look at every avenue possible in these next few months in terms of to develop the pools that we need for our critical vacancies.
Because I see that as a great resource. We've got some great community colleges in this region, and I think they would be more than willing to talk to you about putting in place programs, especially if they know that the job's at the end of the line. So I would urge you to move quickly on that one.
Yes, we will.
Okay. I'm trying to get my arms around the money part of this. I appreciate that we're going to ramp up and all of that. But so I'm looking at this quarter one, quarter two, quarter three, quarter four of FY13, and I'm thinking about the fact that my jurisdiction gets charged, gets billed quarterly, and you know, whether we make these or not has a potential impact on the budget, right? Either in the overtime or the other manner. So one of my questions is, I continue to be concerned that we're going to have skilled job, silver line people on board at quarter two of 13 when we're not going to start running till quarter three of 14. So I have them for a full year that I'm paying these skilled folks, and some of this is me not understanding exactly how the railroad works, but I think it would be helpful for you to help us all understand that a little bit better. And then the other question I really have, and it is about how we pay and when we pay, is given these different headcounts, is that going to affect my quarterly flow of cash? Am I going to be, is this, are you looking at a level payment next year, or are you looking at something that's tied to whether or not you achieve these things?
Well, let me answer that one first, and then Dave can answer the first one. So, as you know, the operating and capital work a little differently. So with respect to operating, and I would argue that I think the predominant amount of vacancies that we see here are job skills that have to be filled are mostly the force account labor that we need for the capital program. But let me address the operating first. So on operating, as you know, we have an approved budget. Once that's approved, we do a quarterly billing to the jurisdictions. At the end of the day, when there's a surplus, that surplus is either provided back to the jurisdictions in the subsequent year or would be dictated by the committee and the board on how they want to use that. And so that would be a vehicle with which to provide budget back to a jurisdiction. With respect to the capital, it's a little different because the commitment on the jurisdictions and the federal government is a six-year one. And so it is, does not work on an annual basis, nor should it. And so in order for us to ramp up to the spending rate as the targets that Mr. Sarles has and we all have, we actually have to ramp up and have that long runway of a plan and a commitment in place in order to do it. So there is no we're cognizant in the CFA and the capital funding agreement that the jurisdictions want us to spend on an expenditure basis. That's how we're measured. And so our incentive is to forecast on an 18-month basis what our spend forecast is going to be, and we actually strive to meet that. So it works a little differently than an annual basis, and it should because it's a long-term plan. And Dave can answer the other question.
On the hiring phasing of for the Silver Line, for example, what we're trying to do here is focus out on the overall and include all the steps. It's going to take a certain amount of time for HR to go out to actively recruit hire and to physically get people in place. Then we're faced with the task of getting employees, you know, trained and ready for certain areas. For example, a train operator, that takes them a minimum of 13 weeks to go through a class before they're even eligible to become qualified. So you're going to have a lot of different skill sets that are noted in this report. Traction power is going to take a different length of time, automatic train control. Then we have the activities of the startup or the commissioning of the rail line, and then you focus yourself into full revenue service operations. So when you start adding all of those components, that's why we're in a position of trying to back this thing out in realistic modules to ensure day one, whenever we do start carrying customers, that our employees are properly trained and are competent. The other thing is also important is as we hire these employees and we add this new system, there's a union pick and there's a shift pick. So there's also a lot of resources towards we have to familiarize not only the people that we're bringing on board, but also the existing workforce and stuff as well. Because, you know, by seniority, they can pick, you know, their certain zones and such. So there's a lot of detail that has to be worked, and that's pretty much in every classification that we have.
And I guess you said you walked through those steps, but we're putting in place a workforce that will be trained, but that the experience levels will be varying in terms of throughout the railroad, so that when we start, you call the commission or testing or whatever is going to happen, we have that to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, pretty much to take the position is that for us to go out, for example, to hire a license and properly train traction power person, those people pretty much existed in the existing railroad. They have their establishment and stuff. It's not like there's a crop of them out there for us. So we really have to take it from an entry-level standpoint or technical skills program, and it's our job to develop and mature these individuals into the skill sets that we need. So that is another player into that.
Okay. Mr. Downs, and then we're going to finish up.
They do exist. New Jersey Transit, SEPTA, the MTA in New York, recruit all over the corridor. I remember when I was the chair at New Jersey Transit that we aggressively recruited from WMATA about those skill sets, and were more successful at times than I had anticipated. It is not unheard of in this region to recruit specific skill sets from existing workforces in other transit properties, and I don't think we're aggressive enough about that right now.
Well, one of the things that stands in the way of that is if you work for a railroad today, you're not going to come here because you got your railroad retirement to protect, and we've found that already. So we do look to power companies who train linemen, but you still have to get them acclimated to this. So, and we look to coal miners because they like to work in tunnels, right, Rob? So, you know, those are the types of things we do look at.
All right.
Next slide, please. Okay, I'd like Rob Troop would now give you a brief discussion on the capital program.
Good morning. Rob Troop, Assistant General Manager, Transit Infrastructure and Engineering Services. You know, obviously one of the questions is how these positions will benefit the rail system. As Bill had pointed out earlier, from 2005 to 2010, we did have a downsizing of personnel, both in engineering, capital, and operations. This resulted in an underinvestment in our maintenance. We project that we need to do 12,000 ties annually just to maintain a steady state of maintenance. You can see by the chart that in the previous years, we were only doing 5,000 per year. What happened is right now we have a resultant backlog of 75,000 ties. Through our processes of employing new equipment, getting some personnel on board, we have been able to increase our rate to 12,000 ties a year. And we are at a steady state right now. However, the backlog needs to be taken care of. So we're projecting that we need to do 20,000 ties per year over the next 4 to 5 years in order to make up that backlog while still maintaining our steady state of maintenance. And the investment in personnel allows this level of production. You know, of course, ties is one component of the railroad. infrastructure, and the same holds true for all the other components that are out there as well. We have backlogs in all the items, such as fasteners, third rail, and rail, just to name a few. So these positions, in addition to our investment in equipment, allows us to increase our levels of production so that we can make up the backlog and get to a steady state of maintenance, and therefore provide the level of service that our customers, you know, expect and deserve. So this is you know, indicative of, you know, where our efforts are leading with these personnel. It's indicative of where we're going with equipment, you know, that we recognize the backlog, and that these are the types of things that we need to address quickly, you know, in order to have the level of service that's required.
Mr. Downs and Ms. Porter.
I want to thank the staff and the general manager for producing this. This is the first detailed, forward-looking forecast, and it's only, as you point out, on one element of the system. It would be helpful forecasting forward what a real cost is attached to this 12,000 ties a year as a part of the ongoing operating cost of the railroad. I think we got in trouble as a railroad by not being able to clearly define and budget for those, and when we decided we'd whack capital funding, we fell in a hole. I would love to see this for switches, for rail fasteners, for power, the other elements of the system, including car replacement, car maintenance, as part of the operating part of the railroad. We have obligations in capital to keep the railroad going, and we ought to be able to do this for each element going forward and put a price tag on it so that we know that there are costs in operating the system.
We do have tables for those items that you indicated. We have done the projections out in the backlog and what we need to do to be able to make up those backlogs. Again, you know, the capital budget and the operating positions within this budget projection does include those items in addition to the equipment that, you know, we're getting through the capital budget. So those figures and numbers are available. We do have unit costs associated with each of those items, whether it be linear feet of rail or unit cost per tie. So those numbers are available as well.
I think it's really important because we tend to get lost on headcount and capital expenditures. We don't focus on what we're buying. And this is a way of focusing and explaining to the public what we're buying, what it's for, what it produces over time.
And how successful we are.
And how successful.
And this is the information we've been developing over the last few months to tell that kind of story. This is an example.
I want to agree with everything Mr. Downs said. And also, this particular graphic I found very helpful, just as a graphic. And I think it's a little, as you mentioned, it's only for the ties, and it's also just a little bit too complicated. But if there was a way that we could simplify this and then make it more comprehensive, I know those two things go in opposite directions, but if we could, there are ways to figure out graphics, because I looked at this, and this is the answer to a lot of the kinds of questions I get about, you know, when are you guys ever going to be finished? Are you making any progress? What's going on? Why is it taking so long? If this graphic is the answer to those kinds of concerns, it shows how long it's going to take to eliminate the back on this particular thing. And there ought to be a way of putting together something like this that is explanatory to someone who doesn't sort of understand the system as well as supposedly we do. So I'm speaking for myself. But I think that this could be a very useful thing for answering some of those questions if we could figure out a way to convey it perhaps in a little bit more intuitive way.
Madam Chair, yeah. I would agree with everybody, and I would wonder, you know, we certainly are hearing it from Red Line riders right now, where we are working so intensely across a number of these elements,
And so the when does it, you know, what's the delta here where it gets better?
Well,
to figure that out would be really wonderful to begin to say, you know, you've been in the mix here for however many years with Redline, but here's where we begin to really think you're going to see the huge difference.
Well, one of the things on the red line that we have undergoing right now, we have two major initiatives outside of our, you know, achieving the steady state of maintenance. We have the initiatives for the guarded number eights, which is an NTSB recommendation. And we also have the initiative for the track circuits, which, again, is an NTSB recommendation. So, you know, that work is taking up, you know, a certain amount of time through the shutdowns, you know, that we're doing. And where we can, we maximize those shutdown efforts to be able to put track work elements in there. We can't always do that with the track circuits. It's difficult because you need the track circuit in place or the track, the rails in place to be able to install them and test them. On the red line specifically, we're probably looking at 3 years out. And again, the railroad is a very integrated function. You know, it's a lot like a spider web. There's, you know, one component can cause, you know, a low performance in another. So with the introduction of, you know, ATO, when we get the track circuits done, with the introduction of the 7K fleet, and with the current track levels that we're doing, you know, we expect to have a significant on-time performance level increase on the red line within that time frame. We believe so, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let me just say I kind of like the chart, so don't mess with the chart. You know, I think I would argue that at some point doing 1,200 ties annually after we get to the end of our backlog, we won't need to do 1,200 or 12,000 annually. It'll be some maintenance level. So what that is eventually. But at some point, I think, and Mr. Downs, I believe, articulated well, you know, what is the impact of not only just the ties and all the other parts of the system on service and service delivery and breakdowns and whatever. And that would be kind of interesting. And that'd be a very complex chart, I guess. But work toward it if you can. But I like the chart.
Also, to the point on the red line, I would like to say, you know, that some of the things that we deal with also, because, you know, we have a lot of adjacent properties, a lot of the highway authorities that, you know, run over us, and they're doing the same types of things we are. You know, they're you know, improving their infrastructure as well. And sometimes that impacts us. Like, for example, on the red line, Newark Avenue. You know, we have multiple single-track outages to support those work efforts that are being done at New York Avenue. So while, you know, not all of it is a result of, you know, simply us doing maintenance, but it's also supporting, you know, other elements of the greater Washington area, you know, improving their systems as well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I guess one piece that I would connect with the chart, Mr. Green, would you like to go?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't mean to interrupt. We were prepared to go into the appendix to get to your detailed questions about the staff.
I'd be glad to. I just wanted to say that I think we really, in connecting the charts and connecting the service reliability piece is really what the picture that needs to be painted, so that when our customers aren't going to be able to look at this chart, but they're going to see the amount of work that's being done every day and the better we get with the videos and the others in showing what that actually does is one that's going to answer the question about the service reliability and the state of the repair that we're in. So I think it's a very good chart, but we have a lot more we can add with that. Yeah.
Let me just make one other observation and maybe ask a question about the open houses that we're going to have related to the budget, because for the general rider, the issue is I'm paying more and service is not necessarily getting any better. And so to the extent that we can address that particular issue, and it's not just showing the videos, although I agree the videos are really helpful for people to understand how complicated this is, but the real question on people's mind is, when's my ride going to get better? So if there's a way in the open house to begin to figure out how to talk about this, so that people can see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, even if it's longer, that, you know, 3 years kind of makes me gasp. But nonetheless, I think we have to start being clearer about that piece of it and put the money in that context.
Okay. I'll give it back to you.
Thank you. We're now going to go into the appendix of the presentation, and we'll give you, you had requested some detailed information about the various initiatives, and also there'll be a discussion about the staffing, and we'll also get to your point of what are we delivering in these various initiatives. So overall, we've been through this slide before. I'll go quickly through it. 255 positions for capital as we ramp up to a $900-plus million program. 363 positions associated with the Silver Line, 11.5-mile, 5-station rail segment. 194 positions associated with maintaining the baseline, including requirements to maintain new facilities that we rolled out at Penzi Drive, Shepherd Parkway, Bus Garage, and adequate rail car maintenance for the 50% 8-car trains and blue-yellow line split. Additionally, 255 system investment positions are required to implement fatigue management, first responders communication capability, and Dave and his team will get into this in detail in the following slides.
Good morning. They'll do a good job of covering everything. If I could, just be patient with me on this, because some of these are a simple page, and then others are multi-page, and if we try to put everything in one area, we'd probably be looking at about number two font. So we'll start with the capital side. The capital side is pretty straightforward. These are just positions that are for the capital initiatives at this stage. One of the things that we'd want to also note is as we move forward, for example, these positions could be moving over into other areas, and we'll use like the train control module recommendation that we're working on. Right now we're focused very heavily on the red. We're starting to ramp up our work on the orange-blue. As we finish work on the red, some of this staff would naturally transfer over to the yellow-green. So it is going to be, you know, multi-year initiatives. Some of these disciplines are probably positions as we phase out some of these projects could be utilized to hire maybe some of our existing or fill some of our existing vacancies. And there could be other services where we just really do not need their task anymore at this time. So it's really tied in with the capital project across the board. And I think this is just a single-page snapshot on this one here. Okay, going forward, the Silver Line staffing, I believe this is a multi-page. Yes. And so we could go back to the first slide, please. This is just really about the ability for us to operate, you know, phase one, and we broke down all the respective skill sets that we see that are required for that. Next sort of grouping, next page.
Madam Chair, are you taking questions in this?
Yes, go right ahead.
So, Mr. Kubitschek, so several people who've seen these slides have said to me, if I divide the supervisors into the actual worker bees, I get a really high ratio of supervisor to worker bee. I don't know if that's a fair thing to do, but if, like, look at just systems maintenance in the on the first slide where you have 64 mechanics and 13 supervisors. And I do the math, and it's one supervisor for every five people. So is that fair? Is that what you're saying here, or is there some other way to look at this?
The term supervisors is also integrated with like kind of like a lead technician or lead person as well. So they do carry a dual role.
Okay, well. So they're worker bees, but they're supervising other worker bees.
Yes, we have layers of staff, you know, based on these specialized skill sets. And for example, the being that's in system maintenance, that gets into automatic train control, traction power, where we have some very concise requirements for those job sets.
Okay, I'll take your word for it, I'll take your word for it that these are the same ratios that you have in other places. If I were to look at systems maintenance and the rest of the railroad, it would stack up the same. I don't know that.
It's the other
kind of question that people are asking.
Yeah, we're trying to basically instill the same basic philosophy that we're applying elsewhere.
Okay, let me ask one other question. If I divide this $20.3 million by the 363 positions, is that a fair way to get at average salary?
I don't know about an average salary.
No, it's the correct answer. The $20 million also includes non-labor costs. So, and depending on the initiative, we would have different. It's staged through the year, but just on the flat cost calculation, that would not be an accurate way to do it.
both things have been said to me, so.
Any other questions on Silver Line?
Yes, Mr. Downs.
I was looking for the overall personnel cost charged to capital, both headcount and total budget on the human resource side of capital. Is that is it readily accessible? And if so, in this budget, what's the total capital headcount and what's the total capital payroll charge, fringe, overhead, et cetera?
Yeah, we can talk about it here. It's in the budget books that we handed out.
I remember seeing something like $123 million
sure.
worth of personnel.
There's one page in the budget book that actually allocates everything associated with labor, fringe assumptions, benefits, and it gives you an average cost, if you will, for employee. There's another section where we outline the headcount, whether it's capital or operating. So.
I'm just interested in how much capital is going to personnel cost and the headcount in the coming year's budget. If it's I remember from the budget book, it was like $123 million worth of total capital going to personnel cost.
I'll get that exact number for you, but I can tell you the headcount is about 1,270 positions in capital as opposed to 11,000 in operating. And I'll give you the precise okay. estimate for the capital personnel costs.
It's something to pay attention to because over time, the personnel costs charged to capital are at a capital cost.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we actually are required by federal law as we actually every quarter report our forced account labor associated with capital. We're very aware of it. We amend it as capital projects move. So we can report that to you.
Because at $123 million a year, obviously over 10 years, it's $1.2 billion worth of personnel cost on capital charge.
Mr. Bolger.
Thanks. Help me understand why we need 24 elevator and escalator for the Silver Line staff up. I've asked this question many times. Are we going to be fixing these things right off the day one, or is there a warranty from these companies that we're buying, and we're buying better escalators and better elevators? And
great question.
And why do we have to have 24 people day one to staff it?
Mr. Bolger, just so happens we talked about this one here. On the 24, when we put this together, as everybody is aware, we have an existing solicitation that is out on the street right now that is looking for services on the Orange Line. One of those phases is the option for the Silver Line. So we wanted to make sure that we had a placeholder in that to identify potential funding and potential needs, and we'll find out here in the next month or so what the industry comes back with the requirements of what's taking place. But moving in parallel, we definitely needed to have a placeholder for positions because it takes us 4 years unless we hire a licensed, trained elevator escalator technician that is, you know, that can come into this jurisdiction to work. So it takes us 4 years. So we're sitting here in 2012 now facing, and you start pushing the math out a little bit, we're going to be in a kind of a state of flux on that there. So if we don't, if the prices and stuff, you know, come in, we'll push that out. And there's also a warranty period, and there's also a maintenance period that is on the Dulles on the alignment as well. So we're looking at executing that, and that funding possibly could go into this 24 could probably fund that initiative with services, and then we would look at our contracted services contract if that's successful. But I had to identify it one way.
To put it briefly, to put it briefly, I ran across this last night. We had a little discussion on this, and the 24 was put in there because the guys wanted to preserve something for headcount. We're not going to hire those 24 because we're assuming we're going with the contracting for the Orange Line. That's the answer.
Okay.
Okay, if we go to the next package, okay. I think maintaining the baseline, this is a multi-page area as well. This gets back to Mr. Green's earlier comments where over the years there was a reduction in headcount for various tasks and everything else. So basically, in the midst of this, there's other activities that continue to move forward. I'll probably just focus on the facilities and amenities. You know, we're adding garages. So with that, you know, comes maintenance. Also, we have to make sure that we keep these things properly licensed. So that way, working with the jurisdictions. The 51 technicians, for example, rail car maintenance, those positions were in the budget a few years ago, and they were taken out. We're getting ready to deploy the blue-yellow line split. We really want to get to the goal of having 50% eight-car trains, and we want those technicians and such, and we need those individuals on board, not only for that, but also as we move forward with Dulles, we start adding additional fleet and services, you know, with that. Our spare ratio is going to reduce for a certain period of time as we handle the transition of the 1,000 series being integrated and retirement of the 1,000 series. So that's the importance of that, so that way we can sustain that as smoothly as possible. And the infrastructure side is basically some of it's related to NTSB recommendations. That is further justification. It's making sure that we're following, you know, regular and national codes on how we maintain some of these systems. The next slide. Again, it's just basically gets into other services, other areas that, you know, that were cut, and that completes this little packet here for baseline.
Yes, Mr. Dent.
So we could say if we had a steady state system, this is what it takes to operate that system.
Yes.
And on some of these, I assume it's a net. I mean, we have a new garage that's open. We have closed an old one. But net, this is what it takes to provide the level of service that we propose to have.
For
example, we have not been providing because we have not had the people.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Downs.
I notice there's no budget number, even a placeholder for the maintenance contract for escalator elevator maintenance on the orange line, although it shows a 60 headcount reduction.
And just like the other discussion on the 24, the staff was putting in the additional as if the Orange Line contract would not occur. Okay, that's why that 60 has been taken out. It's in the budget to do it as contractor work.
But the it's not 60 headcount is out of the budget?
Yes.
The costs are out.
The cost was never there. What it was a double count in terms of we had in the budget, the money to do the contract for the maintenance of the Orange Line. Headcount was put together. Staff was looking at under the old system of getting authorization for headcount just in case. It wasn't adding more budget to it. It was just adding headcount. And that's why it's been subtracted out, because we're not going in that direction. We're going in the direction of the contract.
Is that part of the reconciliation?
It has another reconciliation.
Yeah. Okay.
This is the next major category, and this is actually where the $60 million would reside. Or excuse me, it's not $60 million. $8
million. We can go to the next slide, please. This right in here is where, with all of that work that we're doing in capital, upgrades, additions and stuff that's taking place, one of the first ones you see here is identification for fatigue management. You know, getting our hours down towards, you know, employees or working a more, you know, standard configuration. This right in here is basically across the board is just to make sure that we have the right balance based on the investments and the improvements that we see coming to the system. If you go to the next slide, please.
I'm not sure if you could stay on that slide for a minute. Okay. On the fatigue management, assume this kind of funny mix. There are helpers and supervisors. There's no workers. I don't know how you're going to reduce the overall overtime unless that's a function of the hiring approach.
We've got nine supervisors of power.
Out of this total, it's 75 helpers and 16 supervisors.
If I could also clarify, mechanic helper, that's kind of like the entry level, and then they have progressions where they go up within their skill set.
Ultimately be doing.
Yeah, we have multiple steps within that skill set.
So a different crew has a certain number of workers, a certain number of helpers, and a supervisor. On the fatigue management, if you could give us some background analysis of how these were arrived at, how do they relate to the goal you have to reduce overtime, and then what the financial implications are, because there is certainly a dollar saving as well if we do work with regular workers as opposed to overtime.
Yeah, sure. We can provide that information.
If you could give us background, that'd be helpful.
I was remembering the JCC staff review of overtime, and I don't remember that power was one of the areas where there were significant amounts of overtime listed on the report, and I thought that there was, in effect, a side agreement about limiting overtime on power.
We have an effort. Our first,
this is the end of the year.
Yeah, the power people were part of the a larger group of people where there were issues with overtime. The three identified groups were ATC being one, the equipment operators being other, and then the power being one. So they were identified in there. I'm sorry, and the second part of the question was?
The side agreements that you've been able to work out with individual bargaining units about
yes, and what we've been able to do there, it's been a multifaceted approach to there. One of the things we've done for the track personnel is we have been able to line the shifts better so that we have three 12-hour shifts for those. We are limiting for the ATC group. We will limit the overtime. We're starting initiative at the beginning of April to limit those to 14 hours. But in order to normalize those work efforts, further, you know, we need to have these people because not only are we going under the fatigue management issues, but we also are developing more processes and procedures according to the NTSB recommendations in regards to testing of track circuits, cable measuring testing, a lot more initiatives that are coming out as a result of that. In addition to the power personnel, you know, as we go through the work and our maintenance efforts increase, you know, the requirements for red tags are increasing as we see that increase. So we know that we will need to, you know, follow that up. So that is an absolute necessity for us to be able to support the work. The power people are a huge function of support for both capital and our regular maintenance activities. In regards to supervisory outage, hot sticking, and doing the red tags for us.
It's Ms. Hampshire-Cowan.
The 32 positions for police officer positions for bus is great. I'm curious to know what's our net increase in police officers compared to current budget, and then is that net increase a restoration of positions previously lost through vacancies, or are we really building the number of officers closer to what the number should be, given the size and length of our system?
Well, somebody looks up the actual number to answer your question. We are doing a couple things. One is we could have lost, I think it was 20 officers on the anti-terrorism side because we lost the federal funding for that ended. So we have to absorb that in the budget. So that's keeping that at the same level. These 32 are straight addition. Then there's the addition for the Silver Line. That's a straight addition. Beyond that, what we're doing is using special police for some functions. That then frees up police officers. So we're hiring more special police, but that frees up police officers to do regular duty. Somebody will give you the right number when they.
I think Chief will answer some of the questions, but the increase is a total of 69 I enforce, and that is all the initiatives, including the Silver Line, some of the bus baseline that we're increasing, but the chief can address the specifics of that.
Yes, there will be a considerable increase in police officers. If you recall back a year or so ago when we had the buses stolen, and so we brought on special police officers to provide protections to the various bus divisions, and so now this is an effort to, in the area of police for bus security, to enhance that. We're adding more police officers for the buses to address the ratio of police versus rail, and so working with Jackie Jeter and 689 and Jack Requa, we can provide more uniform presence on the buses as well.
Yes, Mr. Bolger. Mr. Bolger.
Walk the board through, Chief. Take the federal money for anti-terrorism, okay, knowing or not knowing it was going to run out, and what's been the situation where, unless you can't talk about it, for having to absorb that number of anti-terrorism officers.
Sure. I think it was a decision that was made looking at most of your larger transit agencies over the country. The Department of Homeland Security and TSA recognized that there was a need to enhance uniform presence in view of the fact of the terrorist concerns. And I think recently in the news it highlighted the concern again for terrorist activity. What these officers provided were increased uniform presence. It was providing the ability to look at vulnerabilities and make sure that we can mitigate some of those vulnerabilities by doing a lot of security screenings, going out, checking facilities, of which we have an enormous number of facilities, and it proved to be very effective, and we are very grateful that the general manager recognizes that the continuation of adding more police officers so that the public sees more uniform presence and that we can adequately patrol the trains, patrol the bus divisions and the yards, that we can continue to do that.
Yes, just briefly, the federal funding, when it was given to us, was recognized to be only for a term, and that at the end of that term, we would have to either end it or we would pick it up with our own local funds. So that came as no surprise. This is the budget year, FY13, when that occurs. The choice was to either do it or not do it. My recommendation is to continue it.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Downey.
Just to follow up on that, obviously the threat has not gone away. Federal money has gone away, but I assume we will still, with our own resources, be doing what we think is adequate on anti-terrorism.
That's my recommendation, yes.
All right. Ms. Kissel, will I finish up? I think it's Mr. Rinkle.
I think that Jack Rieke was going to just address the bus priority quarter piece.
Thank you. The proposed budget has two phases of proposed service adjustments, $3.2 million in net subsidy increases for service adjustments to the priority corridor networks. Again, we have 24 priority corridor networks that produce over 50% of the ridership on the entire system. There's a great deal of demand to improve service, increase capacity, and try to improve on-time performance. The second phase is $1.2 million in net subsidy increase for adjustments in running time adjustments, schedule adjustments for the remainder of the system. And as a result of that, our calculations indicate that if, with those approvals, that we would need about 26 additional people to provide those services.
Any other questions?
Okay, so that ends the presentation for this FA. We have a lot of follow-up questions, which we'll provide information to the committee.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Kissel. Mr. Downs has another question.
No, just a comment. I get a headache thinking about what forecasting changes in the budget mean in the out years, not having a multi-year business plan, not having a multi-year budget forecast makes me uneasy about the out year implications of relatively large scale increases in headcount, changes in operating cost. Absorbing a new line means that I think it's really important for the board to have a 3 or 4 year forecast of the implications of this budget going forward. And I would encourage the staff to help the board come to grips with that about future fiscal obligations beyond this budget?
We've given a high level to the committee in the past, but given the detail that's associated with what we have, the construct forward, we can actually update that and provide that three-year look to the committee and the jurisdictions.
Just following up on that. If nothing else, I would assume many of these initiatives will annualize to a higher level in 2014 than in 2013. We certainly should know that if we're signing up for it. What is it really going to cost?
There's no way that we cannot. Okay. Are there any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. If there are any other questions regarding any other items, I guess we can forward them to staff if we have anything. Oh, thank you. I missed the minutes when I started out. So there are minutes from January 19th and January 12th. Can I have a motion for January 12th minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Ms. Hines and seconded by Mr. Downey. Are there any questions? Hearing no questions, all those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? And January 19th minutes, motion for approval?
So
moved. By Mr. Downey, seconded by Ms. Hines. Are there any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you very much. This finance meeting is adjourned and will be followed by a couple.